Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry toko ingoa, ko puki tāpapa, puki wiwi, te maunga, ko te aonga, te awa, ko manakau te whanga, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name is Julie Ferry. I'm the Deputy Chair of the Puki Tāpapa Local Board, one of five Roskill Community Voice reps on that board of Auckland Council. I'm also part of the City Vision Centre Left Whānau across the Auckland Isthmus. I have a regular spot here on Red Alert Radio. I'm very keen to get your feedback. You can find me pretty easily on social media, both Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Julie Ferry. That's spelled F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y. It's a little bit of a strange one there, so that means I'm really easy to find once you spell my name right. We also have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page. Search for Red Alert Radio AKL and you should find us. We put up links to the podcasts of these shows once they're up online, as well as other bits of useful, relevant news and information, links to organisations, that kind of thing. You can get all our past shows on the Red Alert Radio archive on planetaudio.org.nz as well. Today, I'm talking with Jolisa Gracewood, who is possibly best known to listeners from her writing and reviewing career and regular appearances on other much more prestigious radio shows like 9 to Noon. Today, she's here in her role as Deputy Chair and Communications Manager for Bike Auckland, in particular to talk about the current wave of anti-cycling sentiment that we're seeing on the streets and in the papers. There seems to be a real trend just at the moment of blaming cyclists and cycling infrastructure for often unrelated traffic stress, with what's being labelled bike lash. Next week, I'll be revisiting this theme with Dr. Kirsty Wild, who's a sociologist and cycleway researcher. So this is the first of a two-parter. I haven't done a two-parter before, folks, so I'm quite excited. Hopefully you are too. So today with Jolisa, I'll be focusing on what is happening in Auckland, the implications for local cyclists, and what Bike Auckland is doing to address the issue. Thanks, Jolisa, for coming in today. Really appreciate you making the time.
Kia ora, Julie. It's lovely to be here.
Great. So first up, tell us a little about Bike Auckland. What is the organisation? What does it do? And I think one thing people would like to know about, because often people get a bit conspiracy theorist about this stuff, is how you fund it as well.
Right, okay, so Bike Auckland is the non-profit organisation that's working for a better city for people on bikes, and also with people on bikes and via people on bikes. In a way, the bicycle is just a vehicle for a conversation about a better city. Yep. So it's been around for about 20 years, originally as Cycle Action Auckland. And it has roots before that in the environmental movement of the 1970s. So,
wow.
So it's kind of coming full circle in a way. It's run entirely by volunteers and it has two paid staff.
Yep.
So what Bike Auckland does is we advocate, so we campaign for policy and investment that'll make things better for people biking.
Yeah.
We also advise, there's a lot of sitting around tables and filling in forms and doing submissions and so on, talking to all the different agencies that create change on the ground for people on bikes. And then recently we do a lot more of in the way of activation, so events and groups and gatherings and talks and that kind of thing, like bringing people into the room.
Yeah. So that activation, just explain that a little bit more because that's some jargon I'm used to.
Right.
But activation means actually using a space, using the infrastructure, bringing people together.
Yeah, exactly. So a good example would be when Lightpath, the Pink Path, opened.
Yep.
We organised a first hoon on the first night. Just show up. We had no idea how many people might show up on a Thursday night in town. We got something like 1,000 people to
wow.
that first party.
Yeah.
And then last December, which was the second birthday of the Pink Path, we had a Lightpath Festival. So
yep.
we kind of took over the street down at the bottom of Mercury Lane. We had about 5,000 people show up for a street party.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, it's building. It's giving people a chance and a reason and an excuse to get together. And because often when you're out on a bike, you're sailing along one side of the street and you see somebody else on the other side of the street. And it's a quick hello, goodbye, and then it's gone. But being able to bring people together and in their communities as well. So we have a network, a growing network of bike burbs.
Yeah.
Premised on the idea that Auckland is a city of villages. There are a couple of really pioneering bike burbs out there, Bike Devonport, Bike Te Aroha in particular.
Yeah.
And they're just local groups of people who just want to get together and go for rides or run bike fix-it workshops or, just kind of giving back to the community at that level. But they know what's needed in their neighbourhood as well. So it's about empowering those people.
That's great. And so how do you fund this work?
So it's funded entirely by memberships. We join Bike Auckland.
Cool.
For a long time, what you got out of that was just the warm glow of supporting a good cause.
Yeah.
Lately, we've got more of a relationship going with the bike shops because they want more bike paths as well. Because every time they sell a bike, they're sending somebody out there to ride, and they want them to have a good time and a safe time.
Yeah.
So now you get various membership benefits when you join Bike Auckland. You can pop along to a bike shop and get a discount.
Cool.
We also have donors, people who support the idea of a more bike-friendly city, and that's basically how we work.
Cool, so there's no big bike behind Bike Auckland.
We wish. People talk about the all-powerful bike lobby, and honestly, if that was happening, I'd be wearing a lot nicer clothes and riding a much flasher bike, but no, it's just good people supporting good things.
Cool. So let's start by looking at some of the plus side of cycling as a transport mode. And I've actually I interviewed Jessica Rose last year, who has been involved with Bike Auckland and also Frocks on Bikes in particular. And we talked a little bit about that there. But from a Bike Auckland perspective, what are some of the advantages? Obviously, you know, advantages to the cyclist in terms of health and, you know, lesser contribution to greenhouse emissions and those kinds of things. Yep. But what are the benefits for other road users, particularly the private car drivers, from an increase in cycling participation and cycling infrastructure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing we could add to that list of personal benefits is reliable journey times.
Yeah,
We were talking about talking earlier about Auckland traffic and how one, you know, a 15-minute trip one day could be an hour and 15 the next day, but on a bike it's always the same.
That's true.
Yeah. In terms of impacts on other people, so congestion would be a big one. So in the words of the old bumper sticker, t-shirt, backpack cover, you'll have seen it out there, it's one less car.
Yeah.
So every person on a bike is one fewer person driving a car.
Yeah.
And Auckland's average car occupancy is about 1.5 people.
Yeah.
So, you know, a person on a bike or two people on a bike is taking, three people on bikes is taking two cars off the roads.
Yeah.
Hang on, I'm not sure about my maths there, but
no,
you get
right.
the picture.
Three people on three bikes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the start of it. It's also somebody who's not angling for your seat on a bus or a train.
True.
And the closer you get to the CBD, for example, in the morning, people taking a bike for that last mile trip are not trying to squeeze onto the train as it gets most crowded and most stressful as it approaches the city. I mean, there's also the question of productivity. So getting stuck in traffic is costing Auckland reputedly $1 billion a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone we can kind of get out of those traffic jams is helping that. Climate, obviously. There's a new study out this week that shows that if Auckland could raise its walking, cycling and public transport levels simply to Wellington levels, we would not only reduce our carbon emissions by 20%, which is huge, we'd also save 57 lives a year.
Gosh.
So that's where the health thing comes in. People who walk and bike are much more likely to get their minimum daily recommended exercise. And when you think about the costs of the diseases of inactivity, you know, we're looking at huge savings across the future, across generations.
Yeah.
What else can I tell you? Safety and comfort. So streets that have protected cycleways are much more comfortable for pedestrians.
Yes.
You have a buffer zone between you and the traffic. They have fewer crashes. They're safer in general for everybody. What else? Then, there's all the intangibles. So bike-friendly cities are generally friendlier cities.
Yeah.
You know, New Zealanders love to travel, and they'll go overseas and they'll visit these European cities, and then they'll come back and be like, it was so nice, I could just walk around, you could sit and have a coffee, all of that stuff. For children, it's about independence, it's about knowing where they live, it's about confidence. The school run, you know, when the holidays come around, if you can get kids back on bikes, then you can have a daily impact on traffic that would be equivalent to that school holiday effect.
Absolutely. And I have to say with the bike one, it's been great to see bikes in schools start to develop. They've now got a track that... you know, learning skills track that's recently opened at a local school in May Road in my area. And that actually came off the back of the local board putting a very simple sort of bike around the outside of a small reserve track into that community. And from that, the school was like, well, the kids love this, so let's look at doing a more advanced, you know, bigger track on our school grounds. And then that will drive those that will encourage those children to cycle not just to and from and around school, but then when they go to intermediate and when they go to secondary, And my kids, they walk to school now. They live within, we live within a reasonably short walk of school, and there's a walking school bus as well.
Yeah.
But my 10-year-old is already excited about cycling to high school, which is further away.
Isn't that fantastic? And you've got the Roscoe safe routes as well.
That's right.
So that's the other part of the picture, is the kids have to have somewhere to ride outside of the school grounds.
Yeah.
Bikes in Schools is amazing. They've empowered dozens of schools in Auckland, hundreds across the country, with a fleet of bikes and a little track inside school grounds, as you described, for learning to ride. And there's a figure that Patrick Morgan from the Cycling Action Network uses, that what it costs to equip one school with its little fleet of bikes and its little track is the equivalent of somebody with advanced diabetes having dialysis for a year.
Wow.
So you can make that investment at the beginning of somebody's life, or you can make it at the end of their life. If you make it at the beginning, you're equipping a whole school with a sense of how to bike, an option for healthy transport, all of that stuff. And it's so logical.
And kids then go home and infect their parents too. Which is a wonderful impact. And I mean, we've seen that with the conscious adoption of recycling in schools.
Yes.
You know, and that's been a conscious effort to go, look, if we get kids doing it, they'll encourage their parents to do it at home.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of other things we could learn from there. And
absolutely.
How do we transmit the learnings at school? Learnings, sorry. I don't like to use that word.
I know what you mean.
The lessons learnt at school.
Back out into the family and the community.
That's right.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And I mean, the other thing to bear in mind is that the number of children biking, the proportion of children biking and walking to school has dropped precipitously inside one generation.
Yeah.
And we could sit back and say, oh, well, that's just natural. That's just kind of what happens. But we don't do that for the kakapo. You know, we didn't do that for the black robin. So what it's going to take is some really serious investment in what you might call predator-free spaces we can kind of grow that population back up again.
That's really interesting, because I often think about the impact on walking in particular from when Teresa Cormack disappeared, because I was at primary school when that happened and I had previously walked to school and it was about a kilometre, so, you know, not a short distance for a primary school student.
Yeah.
And everybody walked to school, and for about 2 or 3 weeks after she disappeared, I got driven to school, and then my parents went back to me walking to school.
Yeah, interesting.
But a lot of other people didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've already mentioned the impact on the traffic of the school run.
Yeah.
For me, we don't do the school run because, as I said, the kids walk, but I have to get across several blocks to get to the centre that my youngest goes to.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to be able to do that actually on a bike. It would have to be an electric bike in my case.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm seriously considering in the future. But one of the issues is my perception of the safety.
Right.
As the parent.
So
thinking, got a little bit off the bike lash topic. That's okay. So thinking about the anti-cycling sentiment, you know, we've talked a bit about these positives and our own aspirations, yours on behalf of Bike Auckland, me more for my little family.
Yeah.
Where do you think this anti-cycling sentiment is coming from? We've had angry letters to the paper. I mean, there's always angry letters to the paper, but it's particularly interesting to see, you know, cyclists have been referred to as cockroaches.
That's awful.
Cyclists reporting people being rude to them on the road, even when they're obeying the road rules. And personally, I've had that experience.
Yep.
And I don't cycle a lot, so, you know, it's statistically unlikely that I would get that.
Yeah.
We've even had someone occupying a traffic island taking to a curb with a sledgehammer. What's going on?
Such a good question. And I think it is kind of connected to what we were talking about before, in that I think it's generational.
Right.
It's an expression of anxiety about change.
Yeah.
So the thing about bike lash is it's both completely normal and explicable. And then also, for me, the more I think about it, it's extremely unusual that it's happening in New Zealand. So in some ways, and I guess you'll talk to Dr. Kirsty Wild about this, is it's a global phenomenon. It's normal. It's a good problem to have. It's a sign of growing pains. It's a sign that something's finally happening. In terms of Bike Auckland's kaupapa, it's, you know, like, here is the investment. The bike paths are being built. They're being used. Key Street, for example, it's doubled. Less than 2 years.
I finally got to go on that the other day on an Onzo bike.
Brilliant.
It was great.
Isn't it great? And it'll be extended and it will double again and it will connect through to the path to GI. It'll double again. So it's happening. There's this huge suppressed demand, this kind of intangible joyfulness when you build the paths and connect them up.
Yeah.
So that stuff is happening. So where is the bike lash coming from? It's part of a process of change. When I think about what's changed in Auckland in the last 20, 30 years in my kind of adult lifetime, we've got twice as many houses. You know, we subdivided everything. We've got twice as many people, twice as many cars.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff happened and we weren't necessarily consulted about it.
Yeah.
Now we're fixing the last bit of the puzzle, which is how do we use our roads most efficiently to get all this stuff moving and keep it moving? And that's been consulted on.
Right.
And so I think it's finally a chance for people to have their say, and it's a real lightning rod for a whole lot of anxiety about a whole lot of other change. In some ways you're asking people to rethink their space, rethink their habits,
yeah.
And if it's a place that they think of as their patch, so, you know, out the front of some shops where the shop owners feel like that's kind of their spot, or running through neighbourhoods where people might feel that they've been there for a long time and there's been changes and they want to just stop that change happening. I think in a general sense that's what's happening. But the bit that makes me go, why, is if you turn it upside down, if you ask New Zealanders in general what their values are and what they prize,
yeah.
They'd say things like, oh, we're clean, we're green, we're sporty, we're not afraid of a bit of rain, we like climbing hills, even Hillary didn't get where he is today without climbing a big hill.
Yeah.
We're innovative, we're world leaders, we solve problems. People would agree that they're horrified by the road toll, that they're worried about public health. They definitely agree if you ask them that kids on bikes are like a Kiwi treasure. You know, it's like swimming in rivers. Kids on bikes, what could be more natural, more normal? So it would seem like a no-brainer that we'd all be like, of course, let's make bike-friendly streets. Why not? You know, and that's the bit that I can't quite get my head around. Because the other thing is if you asked Aucklanders, okay, I've got this magic thing that can reduce traffic, make your neighbourhood cleaner and prettier, give people easy ways to get fit in the course of an ordinary day, cut down on traffic noise, make your streets safer, make sure you've always got a seat on the bus, make your town centre more groovy, they'd say yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's being lost in translation there?
Yeah, I think for some people, I think they're scared that you're going to make them cycle everywhere, Jaleesa. it's that, you know, oh, you'll prize my steering wheel out of my cold dead hands type reaction.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting to me because no one's actually making anyone cycle.
Yeah, we're really not. It's an option. And we do know that Aucklanders and New Zealanders in general love to bike on the weekends. They love to bike on the rail trails. They remember what it was like to bike as a kid. So that kind of memory is there. What is happening there? I mean, there's the article of faith in bike lobbying where, and advocacy in general, where you say, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
Right. So you build the bike path, people show up.
And that's shown to be
absolutely
correct.
It's 100% true. But thinking back through where that line comes from, which is the baseball movie, it also strikes me you don't need to build a baseball diamond to get people to show up and play baseball or beach cricket or whatever.
Yeah.
You just drop the tools on the ground. So you put a baseball cricket bat down, let's make it a New Zealand example, and a cricket ball on a beach and some sticks, and pretty soon you've got a game of beach cricket.
Yeah.
So by analogy, if you have e-bikes that are becoming rapidly affordable, that flatten the hills and kind of make headwinds non-existent, you're creating the conditions for people to have a bike path experience on an ordinary street.
Yeah.
Bike share is another example.
Yeah.
If you're running late and you're walking past a bike that's just there for the using and it's going to cost you less than 50 cents to ride to the train station.
That's exactly what I did.
Really?
Yeah. So, although in my case it was the bus stop that's right by the train station, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a whole lot of parts of the puzzle that are aimed at making biking not compulsory, that would be crazy, but in a way people find driving a little bit compulsory at the moment, I think. And that's one of the constraints that's making people a little bit tense.
Absolutely. And I mean, I get that from people quite a bit, where people are saying, you know, it's all very well investing in all the cycling infrastructure, but I have to drive for these very rational reasons.
Yeah.
And it's sort of having trying to have the conversation with them of, yeah, that's fine. No one's saying you have to cycle. But if more people who can cycle do cycle, then actually it will make your experience as a car driver who doesn't have a choice about that much better.
Exactly. And it's one part of the giant toolbox. So, you know, every now and then I'll be riding at rush hour and I will bike past. I count the cars as I go past. I hope the people can't hear me with their windows wound down. But sometimes I kind of hope that they can when I get to 22, 23, 24, 25. And it's one light sequence.
Yeah.
Each of those cars has one person in them. So carpooling is part of the answer.
Yeah.
And, you know, leaving the car at home a couple of days a week maybe is part of the answer. Experience public transport. Just sit there and read. Yeah. Half of these people in their cars are sitting there and reading. They're looking at their phones because the traffic's moving so slow.
And that's why we have 7 car pileups like we had in Hillsborough earlier this week. Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, take that pressure off yourself and look at the options. And it doesn't have to be a bike. For you, it might not be a bike. It might be something else. But for somebody else, if it is a bike, then that's one more car that you don't have to sit behind. Just makes sense.
Sounds very good to me. You've convinced me. So I've seen a study too, this was a couple of years ago I think, showing that people who are driving are much less tolerant of small breaches of the road rules by cyclists. And I think the example given was around compulsory stops.
Right.
And how a lot of drivers will sort of roll through the compulsory stop. I was actually at an intersection the other day with some colleagues that we're looking at because it's quite a dangerous intersection and we were looking at it with Auckland Transport. And while we were standing there, all these people were rolling their cars through this compulsory stop. We saw a couple of near misses actually, but people seem to be okay with another driver doing it, but they get really irate if a cyclist does it, even though as a cyclist, you know, you'll need to maintain momentum.
Exactly.
The fact that actually, you know, the personal risk to you is much higher so than it is if you're in a car.
Yep.
So, you know, you're kind of, you know, if anyone's taking their life into their hands, you're taking your own life into your hands and you know, your best place to make a decision about that.
Yeah.
So what do you think's going on there? There's no silver bullet, I know. But what is it that, you know, calling cyclists cockroaches?
Mm.
How does that impact on individual cyclists, you know, and their experience of cycling?
Yeah, a huge part of Bike Auckland's work is about putting a human face on things and trying to get beyond, in fact, you used the word cyclist, and I personally try and avoid that.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a better word.
We see people on bikes, kids on bikes, the more specific you can be, the more you kind of break down that assumption that a cyclist is some kind of, I don't know, like sort of Terminator-like robot creature that doesn't have human feelings or needs or a family.
And wears a lot of lycra.
Yeah, wears a lot of lycra, wears high vis and kind of zips past you and all of that. And for a while, that was the only kind of person on bikes on the roads.
Yeah, because that's the only person who could survive.
Exactly, and those guys were out there holding space for the rest of us. And so I have nothing but mad respect for the high vis wearing, lycra wearing, 50k each direction riding. Those hard people are just amazing, and they've kept the faith all these years. Now that we've got safer connections happening, you see much more and more different kinds of people out there. Actually, on the way into the studio this morning, I just bumped into a mum with 2 child seats on the back of her bike, and she said she'd just come from the kindy and school drop-off.
Wow.
It's amazing. So it's changing. And I think that's helping a little bit in terms of building empathy between the person inside the metal box with their hands on the steering wheel and the person outside. I think there is still a kind of in-group, out-group thing. So when you're in a car, you're insulated from the world.
Absolutely.
You think of the road as your personal pathway to freedom, what the car advertisements are selling you.
Yeah.
And on an average morning in Auckland, it doesn't really feel like that.
No.
So I think the level of tension is quite high, and people are very quick to spot somebody who might be getting away with something. And maybe that's what provokes the anger and the fury, is that sense that it's not fair.
And maybe what they're getting away with is more freedom than you're getting sitting in your car waiting.
Precisely. And it's not fair. It's not fair that we've told people that you can hop in your car and expect to get where you're going in the same amount of time every day.
And park right out front.
Park right out the front, all of that stuff. People have been sold a bill of goods, and so no wonder they're mad and a little cranky. The other thing that I hope people are starting to take on board is a sense of empathy for the person on the bike.
Yeah.
So for example, if I'm riding past a whole bunch of parked cars, any one of those cars could have somebody in the driver's seat that's about to fling a door open. It's like running through a minefield, and each car is an unexploded bomb. So I'll ride a little wide. And if people are cranky about that, if drivers are kind of honking or they come around and they yell at me, I generally try and catch up with them at the next light, which is generally easy to do in all traffic. And I'll just gently explain to them that, you know, if that person opens their door, I go under your wheels, and then 3 people are going to be late for work.
Yeah.
And we won't feel very good about it. So, you know.
And that's the best case scenario.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So can we all, 3 of us, talk about how this is a very illogical use of space and the behaviours that drivers might see, like people hopping onto the footpath to get past a really scary stretch.
Yeah.
They're actually often a highly rational response to an irrational system.
Yeah.
That is not allowed space for all the different kinds of road users.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It was interesting you said about moving away from using the term cyclist, because one of the things I'm very aware of and has become the case in my own life, having been very car-oriented, and I used to love driving, now I don't like it because I have to, you know, drive the car. I can't do anything else while I'm driving the car.
Yeah.
But is that a lot of people who are people on bicycles are also people behind the wheel of a car,
yes,
people who take public transport, people who walk. And so that multimodal aspect, you know, you're not 24/7 a cyclist.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I drive every now and then. I have a what I think of as my single occupancy vehicle field trip experience. So I take myself out there in a car and see what it feels like from the other side.
Yeah.
And it's a useful reminder.
Yeah.
We're all just people. We're just trying to get where we're going.
Yes. So how do you think that Auckland Transport and the broader council family are handling this bike lash stuff? Do you think, what are the lessons we can learn from Bike Auckland's perspective? I mean, as you said, you've talked about some of the stuff you've been doing, particularly around, you know, humanising human beings who just happen to be on bicycles for some of the time. But what do you think that Auckland Transport and other organisations like council, more broadly the council family, could be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of messaging, there's some really great stuff happening. I pick up the Our Auckland magazine, and it's usually got a couple of pictures of people on bikes and amongst all the other stuff. That's great. Public commitments. So the new CEO of Auckland Transport came along to the Bike to the Future family ride in Grayland the other day in support of those bike routes which have been temporarily delayed by bike lash. And he spoke of his unwavering commitment to providing cycleways. So that kind of thing is really great.
And I think he doesn't actually have a car.
That's right, I believe,
Yeah, he gets around primarily by public transport.
Yep, exactly, which is kind of cool.
I mean, that's amazing. Who would have thought 10 years ago in Auckland, you know, before the super city, we would have had a head of transport across the region who doesn't drive a car.
Yeah, precisely, who walks the talk or experiences what it's like for all of us.
Yeah.
No, that's magical. And I think there's an increasingly constructive approach to design in terms of bringing on urban design early in the piece. So you're not just going out and plonking down plastic sticks to kind of demarcate a bike lane. You're actually thinking about what the road looks and feels like and how it's a street, it's a place, it's not just a route. That's going to be good. Potentially where I think council could be bolder is giving people more chances to experience what it's like. And we'd love to see but more in the way of pop-up, tactical layouts that give people a chance to see and feel what it might be like to have a safe bike route through the heart of their town centre or something. Open streets events as well, you know, when the Santa Parade happens.
Yep.
And then afterwards
or,
everybody's milling around.
The America's Cup or some kind of sporting event.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. It happens for sporting events, but other cities do it like every weekend in summer. That sort of thing would be lovely. Just to give people a sense that we own this space.
Yeah.
It's not just for funneling cars through. It's actually part of our shared realm.
Yeah,
it's really nice.
That thinking about the open streets and also the temporary stuff, and that's something that I know a number of us have been trying to push with Auckland Transport is, well, let's you know, do it as a trial.
Yes,
and
precisely.
What often happens, and we've seen patterns of this over and over again, is you put something in as a trial, people are like, this is going to be a disaster.
Yep.
It's never going to work. You obviously haven't thought this through. The trial's successful and people change their minds.
Oh, exactly. And there's so many examples of that. I mean, New York City Times Square, for example.
That's the big one,
it wasn't
even
a square. It was two roads intersecting and then they reclaimed the space for people on a, you know, let's just try it basis. And then, honestly, you couldn't prize that out of New Yorkers' cold dead hands right now. It's a space for the people. They love it. It's a total success.
So we're going to have to wrap up in a second, but how can people find out more about this stuff and not just Bike Lash, but all of the this fantastic work that you guys are doing around cycling and Bike Auckland generally? What do they do? Where do they go?
So start with our website, which is bikeauckland.org.nz. We're also on Facebook. We're pretty chatty on Twitter.
Yes.
And we have an Instagram account, so you can find us via your preferred mode of expression. And we send out a regular e-news every couple of weeks that's got the, you know, the most recent bike stories, any submissions that people can take part in, any campaigns and events. And I'd just like to put in a tiny plug for an upcoming event.
Go for it.
Which is the Big Screen Cuisine event in Henderson. They're turning a car park into a, not a drive-in movie, but a walk-in, bike-in movie.
Cool.
And so on the 14th of April, People will be able to just bowl up and watch a movie. If you're coming via the bike paths in the area, the biking and walking paths, there'll be an activity trail and you can collect little tokens along the way and then bring them in and trade them at the food trucks.
Great.
So it's just an extra incentive to kind of get along on a bike or on foot. So that's the 14th of April in Henderson.
And I think the movie's Ratatouille, isn't it?
It is, exactly. Yes. Food-themed movie. So
great.
Yeah, it's super fun.
Cool. So thanks so much, Julissa, for talking with me today. And thanks for listening, folks. Love to hear your feedback. And a reminder that you can listen again to this interview or any of our back catalogue via the Planet FM website, planetaudio.org.nz. Check out programs, we're under R. And don't forget about our Facebook page, search for Red Alert Radio AKL. And next week, you'll have part two of my Bike Lash special with Dr. Kirsty Wild, sociologist and cycleway researcher. So that'll be 9:05 on Thursday the 5th of April. This has been Julie Ferry for Red Alert Radio. Ka kite anō.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalert.